and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Marty Rutherford, Dermot Cole, and Gunnar Knapp discuss Alaska's plans for a natural gas pipeline. The Alaska Constitution reads, "The legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and waters, for the maximum benefit of its people." Today's panelists discuss what exactly it means to ensure maximum benefit as the state evaluates moving forward as a part owner in a North Slope natural gas pipeline project. This talk was hosted by Commonwealth North and was recorded May 28th at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center. Larry Persily moderated this forum. Persily is a board member of Commonwealth North and is also the federal coordinator for Alaska Gas Line projects. Persily starts us off. This talk was shortened for broadcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Commonwealth North's third in a three-part series on the Alaska Gas Line project. Today's panelists, who I'll introduce in a minute, will discuss just how Alaskans might want to think about measuring the benefit of state investment in a large volume, large scale, large cost gas line project, particularly in the context of the constitutional requirement in Alaska that the legislature shall provide for the development of the state's natural resources for the maximum benefit of its people. Commonwealth North in March and April ran a couple gas line forums looking at an overview and analysis of the implications of state investment in a large volume North Slope gas pipeline. Today, we also, in those previous ones, March and April, looked at how investment by the state could affect state finances. Today, we're going to talk about benefits from the project and how to measure those. I probably should have announced at the beginning for people who don't know me, I'm Larry Persily. I'm a Commonwealth North board member. I'm also federal coordinator for Alaska Gas Line projects, former deputy commissioner at the Department of Revenue. So today, as we get into the discussions, our wise and opinionated, but very wise, panelists will discuss, all of you are wise. I'm going to discuss, just how do you quantify the benefits of state investment in the gas line project? Is it just public revenues? Is it jobs? Is it the affordable energy to Alaskans? Do those benefits have to be spread equally around the state or just in the rail belt? How do you get those benefits around the state? Do they have to be spread over generations or do we worry more just about today? So the panelists who are going to take up those questions and others that I don't even know about, we have Marty Rutherford will go first. Marty retired in 2010 as Deputy Commissioner at the State Department of Natural Resources. She has extensive experience with 26 years in state government, much of that time in various positions at Natural Resources, and she is currently Special Projects Manager for the Anchorage Office of Link Energy. Following Marty will be Dermot Cole on the far end of the table, longtime Alaska reporter, columnist, author based in Fairbanks. He has written extensively about Alaska and Alaska history for more than 35 years, a former reporter for the Fairbanks News Miner, currently working for the Alaska Dispatch. His most recent book is North to the Future, The Alaska Story, 1959 to 2009. And then the third panelist is Gunnar Knapp, who has been on the faculty at the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute of Social and Economic Research since receiving his doctorate in economics from Yale in 1981. He is now director at ICER. Gunnar has conducted a wide variety of research on the Alaska economy and Alaska's natural resources. Help me welcome today's panel, and we will start with Marty, and then at the end, like I said, pass up your questions. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Larry, for the invitation. It's nice to be here again. So I believe it's fair to say that there's not much clarity on how to judge maximum benefit to Alaska, nor is there much more clarity on what a best interest finding is. In fact, one of the more interesting conversations I've ever had occurred over the course of almost a month. And that was when John Shively first became commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. John was already a good friend of mine, and I knew him to be extremely well-informed and educated and intelligent. Therefore, when he came into my office sometime early in his first week and said, "Marty, what is a best interest finding, and how do you determine maximum benefit?" I knew this was not a naive question. Nonetheless, I took about 30 seconds, told him what a best interest finding was and what the DNR's processes were, and I thought the discussion was over. About a week later, John came back into my office and asked virtually the same question. Now, this time, I was a little slower in responding, and I told him I'd bring in some of the old-time land managers from the agency and give him a briefing. We did that in about a week, and it took over an hour or so, and I clearly remember that one of the land managers recalled that a previous DNR commissioner, Esther Winicky, and a very dear friend of John Shively's, had always said that these types of decisions must be considered from four basic perspectives. The first was legal, the second was economic, the third was environmental, and the fourth was ethical or moral. I thought this had been an extremely good discussion, and again, I thought it was over. However, about a week after that briefing, John came back into my office and said, "You know, I'm still a bit confused about best interest findings." As you can imagine, this set off some bells, not about John, but about what I was missing. So I began to think about what it was a commissioner, and as it turns out, in fact, what every Alaskan should understand about a best interest finding. And it certainly isn't how the process works. In other words, it's not about moving from a draft best interest finding out to the public process, then back for the commissioner's review, and then finally the issuance of a final best interest finding that can only be appealed to the courts. It took a while, but eventually Barbara Fulmer, Barbara being an oil and gas attorney who at the time was the deputy director of the Division of Oil and Gas at DNR and now works for ConocoPhillips, Barbara and I figured out what we thought were the core of the question, which turned out to be, what is the genesis or what is the authority for a best interest finding? What's required to be addressed within it? What is a commissioner's responsibility when reviewing a best interest finding? What must be considered? What are the facts of the particular decision? And have all of those facts been identified? What's the public's role? And how is their input addressed? How does someone balance the various facts, and how do they balance the various interests? Do the facts drive a decision, or does a commissioner have some discretion in a decision? And how do the Alaska courts view a best interest finding? Once we'd sorted this out, Barbara and I provided yet another briefing. This one took almost half a day, and that's saying something because it was early in a new session with a new governor and a new commissioner, and it was down in Juneau, so you can imagine John's time was at a premium. But I think we managed to answer John's question, because he never asked the question again, anyway. However, I also believe that during this analysis, I determined that this is not only one of the most significant responsibilities for the commissioner of DNR, but it's also one of the most important roles that we as Alaskans have, because at the end of the day, we are the owners of our resources, and we do have a unique opportunity to be involved in the decisions on the use of those resources. So I thought it appropriate today to provide a little background on best interest findings. I'm not going to take the 3.5 hours we gave to John, so you can relax about that. In short, best interest findings are the means by which the state disposes, that means sells or leases, an interest in its lands, waters, and minerals. And within the best interest finding, DNR justifies whether a disposal of an Alaskan resource is appropriate and whether the disposal provides for maximum use consistent with the public interest, which is, of course, required by Alaska's Constitution, Natural Resource Article 10, or excuse me, 8, Section 2 of our Constitution. Additionally, the public notice requirements of the Constitution are also satisfied by this best interest finding process, and that occurs in Article 8, Section 10. The state of Alaska's Article 8 is the very first article to appear in any state constitution that deals solely and broadly with resources. From a historical perspective, our constitutional delegates, one of whom is sitting here in the audience, Vic Fisher, wished to curtail what was seen as abuse of Alaska's resources, particularly the use of the fish traps in commercial salmon fishing. This was seen as an outside-owned interest, and they were blamed widely for the near collapse of the salmon fishery, and it certainly was a symbol of exploitation of Alaska by absentee commercial interests at that time. The constitutional delegates also intended that Article 8 ensure that there would be reasonable development to broaden Alaska's economic base. The chief principle of Article 8 was that resources would be managed as a public trust, which is defined, as you well know, for the maximum use consistent with the public interest, and further defined as utilization, development, and conservation for the maximum benefit of the people. The article also provides for common access to our resources and for all development to be based on sustained yield. The final item in understanding best interest finding is that, in general, the state courts give deference to DNR's best interest findings if they contain the full set of facts of that particular disposal, if they have identified all the significant problems, and if the best interest finding provides a reasonable basis for making the decision. Additionally, of course, the public process procedures must be adhered to. The most recent statement of this by the courts actually occurred in February of this year, and I think it's worth noting here. The Alaska Supreme Court in the Denali Citizens versus State DNR stated, among other things, that, quote, "The reviewing court need only determine whether the decision had a reasonable basis. Under this standard, the best interest finding will survive judicial review so long as it is not arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable." The court goes on to state, quote, "Although this is a deferential standard, the reviewing court must ensure that DNR has taken a hard look at the salient problems and has genuinely engaged in reasoned decision-making, and that the best interest finding includes a discussion of all the important factors that were considered." This background is very pertinent to today's discussion because as Alaska considers maximum benefit in relationship to an investment in a gas pipeline project, there will be many ideas about what maximum benefit really means. Some will view maximum benefits as the most jobs created. Some, the public income, the public revenues that are created, and others from an environmental impact perspective. Many will question whether the benefit is fairly or even equally distributed to all Alaskans. All of these are absolutely reasonable perspectives. The fact is, there is no one correct answer. I will tell you that for me, maximum benefit resulting from a gas pipeline project has some very particular meanings. For almost 6 years, I was totally immersed in gas pipeline issues and the associated negotiations at the state. During these years, I was very committed to three principles. The first was to structure gas pipeline project that was not a monopoly. It is only this that will ensure new companies will find exploring and developing new additional North Slope gas a worthwhile opportunity. This in turn will extend the life of the North Slope operations, it will provide for continuing revenues to the state, and provide good job opportunities to our young. This also means the gas pipeline project must be an open access pipeline, which, among other things, will make it easier for Alaskans to offtake gas for our in-state use. The second principle was to develop a gas pipeline in a manner that does not result in the state of Alaska taking on more risk or liability than we can afford. In other words, to not take any actions where the state cannot foretell the ultimate cost, nor give away our resources, control of our resources, whether that is control of our gas or control of our monies. And the third, finally, is to ensure Alaskans understand the complexity of this project to the best degree possible, so that we can make informed decisions about whether and how Alaska government should be involved in this project. This last one is the key for me, and I believe it should be for every Alaskan. This is a very complex project. It's very different from RTAP's Common Carrier Oil Pipeline. The natural gas transportation and marketing industry is unique. The pipeline systems are not common carriage, they are contract carriage, which makes things complex. It is highly competitive and therefore very risky. Also, the state of Alaska is not a business. It's a government, and therefore we are not properly structured to compete in this industry. Therefore, figuring out how to encourage and facilitate moving this state this mega project forward while not risking Alaska's future is a very difficult decision. So how does this all tie together? This project will impact Alaskans for 25 years at a minimum. What may occur during these years, and what will that mean to the state? What do our decisions today, how will they impact Alaskans 25 years out? And are the risks we are taking reasonable, and are they sustainable? As Alaskans decide how to move the gas pipeline project forward, it must address the maximum value issue. So to reiterate quickly, the constitutional aspects that are required, maximum use consistent with the public interest, broadening Alaska's economic base, resources to be managed as a public trust, development to be based on sustainable yield, as well as the court's requirements that the state take a hard look at all the salient problems, has genuinely engaged in reasoned decision-making, that the best interim finding include all the important factors considered, and that the decision not be arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable. The reality is that in order for Alaska to make this extremely monumental decision on how we intend to participate in a gas pipeline project, it is necessary for us to expect, and I would suggest even demand, that the state fully investigate, identify, and analyze all the options available to us, not just set a course and blindly rush ahead. That we identify the pros and cons of each option under consideration. That we identify and fully evaluate the short and the long-term risks of these options. It's also imperative that this analysis be undertaken by the very best experts the state of Alaska can hire. And that this material, that the data and the analysis be made public so every Alaskan can review the material in order to participate in the decision in a meaningful fashion. So in closing, I'll advocate that because there is no single answer on what maximum value is to the state of Alaska, the best strategy, the only strategy we can employ, is full investigation and absolute transparency of that analysis so Alaskans can make a fully informed decision. With that, I'll turn it back over to Larry, and thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Dermot Cole, a longtime Alaska journalist and author.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure for me to be here today. As I was thinking about the idea of maximum benefit and how that's defined, I want to just give examples of where this has become a challenge and a thorny one, past, in the present, and will be in the future, I think. About 2 years after the pipeline went into operation, there was a movement, and the Ayatollah helped Alaska out by, you know, helping raise oil prices substantially. There was a campaign began in Fairbanks, which some of you may remember, for free oil. The free oil campaign lasted for maybe a year or two. And it was based on the idea, which was probably not shared in Anchorage, that free oil to people in within driving distance of a refinery would be a great idea. So the notion took root in Fairbanks, if not elsewhere, that the state should give oil to the owners of what was then the North Pole Refinery, and then we would have the cheapest fuel in the country. Now, the Hammond administration, and in particular Bob Loresch, who was then the commissioner of DNR, didn't like this idea at all, and so found many ways in which to stymie it. This didn't stop the news miner, however, from writing an editorial about every 3 or 4 days saying how great of an idea free oil was, and that it was irresistible. So it was sort of the capital move to, well, but the capital move was to Bob Atwood at that time. You know? Free oil, though, died probably a pretty good death. In retrospect, it would have been a terrible idea to have done this. But that was how maximum benefit was being defined in that community. And it would be available to people outside of Fairbanks. All they had to do was come to Fairbanks and get the free oil. Periodically over the years, the same idea has surfaced again and again. Most recently, this morning, former Governor Frank Murkowski called me and said, well, I've got a Compass piece I want to get in the Anchorage Daily News. And by the way, Larry, I'm working for the Alaska Dispatch / Anchorage Daily News now, which is a new entity that is taking shape. And for someone who's worked in Fairbanks for 35 years, it's a big change, let me assure you. But former Governor Murkowski is saying we need to reduce the price of oil, we need to set a cleanup level for sulfalane, and we need to divide the responsibility for that pollution in the North Pole area, and then we can get the refinery going again. As you may or may not know, on Saturday at 8 a.m., the largest refinery in the state stopped taking oil. This is a big economic issue for Fairbanks and for the entire state, and a challenge. Is providing low-cost oil to a private company, is that a solution? I think it's easier when you're outside of government to make that suggestion than it is to carry it out when you're in government. Because this is a difficult question. How do you track that dollar that the state gives up through the chain when you're dealing with a private company? No one has yet provided an answer as to how that qualifies as maximum benefit. What the state has typically seen as maximum benefit is maximum cash. There are other benefits as well. Jobs, environmental issues, the economic standard of living, you know. But this issue remains. So right now, the refinery is shut down. Whether or not it will reopen is a question. We don't really know what's going to happen. So that's how this challenge is with us at the present. In large part because of dispute over what maximum value is, the refinery is no longer in operation. Sulfalane is one issue, but also the quality bank is a very large question. And recently, the legislature adopted a subsidy plan that the Tesoro refinery and the Petrostar refinery will take advantage of. But it might be worth pointing out that Tesoro and Petrostar are on opposite sides of the fence on the quality bank. So that's another issue. So we look ahead to the gas pipeline. I think the challenge gets much more difficult than it has been with oil. In part because of the existence of a state corporation, I believe the political pressure to have something akin, if not free gas, low-cost gas, will be pretty strong. You might say that it has existed all along with royalty oil, of course, being state ownership, that why can't we get some of that oil into our homes? But I think it'll be more intense with the gas pipeline because of the political nature of the enterprise we're about to embark upon. That's made difficult for many reasons, one of which is the level of commitment that's required. I don't think the state has ever made a commitment like the one that is being proposed for the gas pipeline. It's hard to make a commitment from 1 year to the next, much less for decades to come. Many of our state political leaders, perhaps with the exception of Representative Sadler, will not be in the legislature when push comes to shove and when the pipeline is in operation a decade or so from now. But this question of what's the maximum value is going to be a really difficult one. We saw it a generation ago with the Rail Belt Energy Fund. in exchange for getting support for Susitna and the Bradley Lake project, one of which was built. The rail belt, there was a power cost equalization effort that came about to benefit rural Alaska. Something similar happened this session in terms of dividing up future gas revenues. That's one way of looking at maximum benefit. We'll kind of, you get some and I get some sort of thing. The real test of that, of course, will be when there's actual money on the table, not just setting up the system in context. I mean, it's easy to have a law on the books. We have a constitutional spending limit, for instance, but it really hasn't taken effect for more than 30 years because of the way it was structured. Anyway, maximum benefit is going to be an issue that we will be wrestling with for decades to come, and I agree with Marty, it's worthwhile getting this all out in advance and explaining it as clearly as possible before we take the next step, which will be in the 2015 or 16 legislature. Thank you.
You're listening to a discussion about Alaska's plans for a natural gas pipeline on Addressing Alaskans. This panel was hosted by Commonwealth North and was recorded May 28th at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center. Panelists include Marty Rutherford, Dermot Cole, and Gunnar Knapp. The panel was moderated by Larry Persily.
Hi, my name is Gunnar Knapp. I'm director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research, or ICER. And being an academic, of course, I had to prepare a PowerPoint, which is mostly so I don't forget what I was going to say. So, as we all know, the Constitution states that the legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and waters, for the maximum benefit of its people. So, what does maximum benefit mean, and how can we maximize benefits from North Slope natural gas resources? As the other speakers have said, and as everybody knows, there isn't any clear or simple definition of maximum benefit. We clearly derive many, many different types of benefits from our natural resources, and we clearly care about many different types of benefits. And this is particularly becomes more clear if you contrast the way we manage different resources, such as oil and fish, and the kind of benefits that we manage for and talk about as we look at those different resources. So when we think about oil, most of the discussion, including an intense discussion we're having right now, relates to, well, how can we maximize the state oil revenues, state revenues from that resource? Although we also have a conversation about other benefits such as jobs and income or in-state refining or municipal oil revenues or so on. So it's not just a conversation about finances, but it focuses on that. On the other hand, if you look at fisheries, an area in which I've spent most of my career, there's almost no discussion in the management of our fisheries resources about how much money are we going to get from the state out of this, right? Who thinks about that? In fact, everybody involved with fisheries argues the goal is to get as little money as possible, but rather to get participation, sort of fishing opportunities for Alaskans, or sport fishing recreation, or subsistence food, or commercial fishing jobs and income. That's what the focus is. So two different resources focus on totally different benefits. So the point is, no particular kind of benefit, there is no single benefit, and many different benefits matter, and in fact, what we focus on varies. So given this, how do we achieve maximum benefit? How does the legislature achieve this constitutional mandate to maximize for the maximum benefit of the people? Well, we have to understand that this is a combination of a technical question and a political question. Ultimately, it's a political question. It's a decision about what values matter. The legislature has to decide that, and as delegated, the responsible state agencies have to work this through for themselves, what what their decision is about maximum benefit. But if we're going to do this in an informed way and have an informed discussion, then we need experts, or we need technical expertise to help inform the discussion. Because for resources like oil or fisheries or natural gas, the technical, there are complex technical issues, so how much money would we get from a project, or how many people would it employ? But we can't call this either solely a technical question or solely a political question. We need both. We need a political discussion, but if it's going to be informed, we need to make it a technical discussion partly. So I want to talk from an economist's point of view just about some of the technical issues in maximizing economic benefit that you face if you sort of want to think through this in a technical way about what even what might these benefits be, or how might you analyze them. And I want to talk a little bit about the inherent complexities of an LNG project, the problem of uncertainty, about revenues as a benefit, jobs, in-state natural gas availability, and alternative investment opportunities. So the point I want to make about complexities is, I think, echoing what Marty said, this kind of project is extremely complex. It's extremely expensive, and it's extremely complex. And it's worth noting, considerably more complex than an oil pipeline or than a natural gas pipeline that's just shipping natural gas, say, to the lower 48. Because this project is fundamentally not a pipeline project, it is an LNG project that involves a gas treatment plant, a pipeline, and a liquefaction plant. And all of these play into it and are part of the cost of building it and part of the how it's paid for and how the payments are derived and the economics of it. We, in particular, an LNG project, this liquefaction plant is a major share of the cost. And it's not the kind of thing, if you have a liquefaction plant, it's not the kind of thing you can easily marginally increase increase throughput. And so the question of how do you provide for expansion of this kind of project is quite complex. And then how is LNG marketed? Generally through long-term contracts, that's another difference. And so you don't sort of marginally, you don't switch around from month to month or year to year how you're marketing this thing to play the market. You make big decisions over long periods of time. And we have a different federal regulatory authority. And all of this affects the costs, benefits, and incentives for project owners and developers. And affects the incentive structure for things like developing new production, expanding project capacity, selling to in-state markets, and so on. And this creates complex and, I would emphasize, non-intuitive issues on things like how you structure the contracts and state participation so as to maximize potential benefits. So the point is, it's non-intuitive, it's complex, and there isn't any way around really studying it hard if you want to maximize benefits. Now, another key aspect of this project is uncertainty. If we're going to analyze future benefits, then we have to, whatever we're talking about, we have to make assumptions about the future. And there are major uncertainties about the future for any natural gas LNG project. And those uncertainties include what prices can we get when we, several years from now begin to negotiate long-term gas contracts. If we then expand in the future or wish to, what market conditions might we face then? Huge uncertainty about the construction costs, uncertainty about the potential scale of future North Slope oil and gas discoveries, uncertainty about future operating risks, earthquakes, accidents, terrorists, what's the small, hopefully small, but still non-zero risks associated with those, uncertainty about what other alternative energy options might come along, uncertainty about our future economic and fiscal situation. Now, nobody knows the future, so it's hard to think about these things. It's sort of hard to, how do you analyze this given this uncertainty? The point is, the fact that it's hard, it doesn't give you an excuse not to think about it. So how do you make critical assumptions based on fundamentally uncertain assumptions? You start by doing these things. You have to always ask for any analysis of what are we getting out of this. You have to say, what are the key assumptions about the future that this is based on, and how sensitive are these results to those assumptions? You have to do that, and you have to be, and we should be skeptical of any claims or analysis that ignore uncertainty or risk or don't tackle this head on. Now, we also have to recognize that many risks and uncertainties simply can't be quantified, but we have to acknowledge them, and we have to somehow incorporate them in our decision calculus. We will never have the luxury of certainty, but we should also avoid the delusion of certainty. Okay, so now, revenues. Obviously, we aspire to gaining revenues, and presumably maximizing revenues is a large part of maximizing benefit from a future gas pipeline. And the point is that I want to make is that this is a complex question. There are many ways you get revenues out of a gas pipeline, and many parts of the equation you have to think about. You have to think about the royalty and tax revenues. You have to think in this proposed project about the tariff revenues from your equity investment. You have to think about not only the revenues you'll get from your current gas resources that you're proposing to ship through, but what revenues might you get from future discoveries if you develop them, and how the project as structured affects the likelihood of that future development of those future resources. And you also have to think about how the structure of the projects affects future oil and gas, oil development, and the revenues from oil, and the effects through the whatever tax formula we have at the time, the effects on oil revenues through things such as costs that you're investing in the oil fields. And to really understand the revenue implications, we need to think about all these things. So my point is, it's complex. We have a lot to think about. We talk about jobs as a benefit, and we talk about jobs as benefits for everything we want to build. But we need to recognize there are potential significant jobs to be created, large numbers of short-term construction jobs, fewer longer-term operating jobs, multiplier jobs in other industries, jobs that we get if we gain revenues and can hire and spend those revenues. All that creates jobs. But we need to recognize that history surely shows us that not all these jobs are going to go to Alaskans, and that perhaps despite the best efforts of our workforce development plan, the highest paid and most skilled jobs are going to have a disproportionate share going to non-Alaskans. And we also know that large numbers of jobs from a project like this can be economically and socially disruptive, as occurred during TAPS construction and is currently occurring in North Dakota and other places. And we also need to recognize that if you're interested in jobs, capital projects are an expensive way to create them, because you spend a lot on pipe for every worker. So we ought to think about, when we're thinking about jobs, how many jobs, lasting how long, doing what, located where, held by whom, and at what cost per job you're created. Now there's this potential benefit or risk, as Dermot and has characterized it, of, well, we're going to have, this is going to make gas available. How am I doing? One more hour? I know I'm running way over. He's going to hand me a notepad. So I'm almost done. There's this temptation to think, well, we're going to get in-state gas availability, and this is going to create wonderful things. But the scale of these benefits depend on the export price of the gas, the extent to which we do or don't subsidize in-state uses, the cost to the users of the distribution networks, the relative availability and costs of other potential sources. You know, it's sort of, it's not just do you get it, it's how much cheaper do you get it than other potential sources. They cut me off, or I cut myself off. There you go. Available doesn't necessarily mean low cost. Okay? Here's a thing to think about. The more valuable the oil is in an export market, the higher the cost, the foregone cost of making it available cheaply to Alaskans. So we're sort of this, we want it to be really valuable in the Far East where we sell it, right? But then the more valuable we make it, the more costly it'll be to give it up to Alaskans, or the less benefit it's going to have in terms of making anything cheaper for Alaskans. I'm going to run through the rest of these slides real quickly because I've more than gone over my time. To maximize benefit, how can you know that you've maximized the benefit unless you've considered the alternatives? You have to think about the alternative investments and alternatives to know, and what are their benefits to know that you've maximized your project. So how do we know if we're going to do all this technical analysis? How do you know if we're achieving maximum benefit? I'd say simply, we have a lot of study, a lot of work to do to sort of know what we're getting out of this project. I think that this discussion has started. The administration has stated what the benefits, presumed nature of the benefits are. There's been some discussion in presentations to the legislature of sort of the potential scale, say, of fiscal benefits and acknowledgement of the uncertainty. But we have a long way to go. We have a long way to go in understanding the benefits of this project. We have a lot of analysis to do before we know what the benefits are, how to maximize them. And I would submit we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to the citizens of Alaska to really study these benefits carefully. We are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to understand the engineering questions associated with this. We should at least be spending millions of dollars to understand the actual benefits we derive from it. So thanks.
The panel's moderator, Larry Persily, fields questions from the audience.
Thank you. Some very good presentations. We got time for a few questions, short answers, and that was not just directed at Gunnar. But this one's for Marty. So one of the questions we have, and this is in the context of, you talked about Department of Natural Resources has to make a best interest finding to sell state royalty oil, and in this case, state royalty gas. In the context of that best interest finding, where you're evaluating the project, evaluating the benefits, do you also evaluate, I'm going to say the option, evaluate not doing anything? I mean, do you measure that against, well, maybe this isn't perfect, but it gets gas, it gets a project, do you evaluate against, in the best interest finding, do you evaluate that against not getting a gas pipeline and not getting gas to Alaskans?
Certainly, under most best interest findings, the department will look at not taking the action that's being proposed. On a natural gas pipeline, would the state look at no action versus whatever action is being proposed? Maybe. I mean, I think what's going to be pertinent is more to look at what the risks and rewards will be associated with the specific proposal. And then a no action is obviously that there's nothing that comes of it. There's no risk that comes of it. There's no reward that comes of it. So in a way, they will look at it, but they won't use it as a stalking horse, no.
Okay. We had another question, and I'll answer this one. What state body would have the authority to regulate the rate for gas that's used in state coming off this project? What state agency would regulate that so you don't have industry selling it at just pennies below diesel? And I guess Dermot Cole, with experience in Fairbanks, would probably agree with this. If it's a regulated utility, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska has to prove their rates. but that's only if it's a regulated utility, and Fairbanks Natural Gas, for example, was not a regulated utility on rates. So if you want to add anything to that.
Right, and I think I'm not sure that the RCA will have a role in the LNG project.
This is Dermot Cole speaking.
Not on the exports, no.
Or even in in-state rates. I mean, that's yet to be nailed down as part of the question mark here. I just wanted to add on one thing that Gunnar said. I don't think the expertise or the structure exists yet to begin to analyze the benefits and risks. I don't think the state is geared up to do this, and it's going to be next to impossible for the legislature to turn down anything, no matter what it contains, because anyone who votes against it will be against the gas line, which is, you know, you might as well take the poison pill.
Gee, and I thought I was dark and cynical and pessimistic. You guys...
The other thing I think, and maybe Dan Sadler can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the piece of legislation that passed actually eliminated the Regulatory Commission of Alaska's oversight on in-state gas sales for this project as it's currently being discussed.
My knowledge of that is that there are some who believe it did cut out the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and others who said, well, it's unresolved. But certainly there is no rate regulation of the gas that is shipped overseas. The question would be gas that is produced and consumed in Alaska. Gunnar, let me ask you, you talked about quantifying the benefits. It's easy if you plug in cost of production, cost of sales, tax rate and such to quantify how much money the state would make off a gas line project. Have you thought about how could you quantify the other benefits to Alaskans of jobs, economic activity, and lower energy costs, say, in Fairbanks? Is that something that could be done with some level of certainty?
Sort of my philosophy of research on this kind of question is there is always a best possible answer to any question of that sort. And so you can, it's challenging to, especially when it's a long ways away and there's a lot of uncertainties, it's challenging to quantify these things very accurately. But what we should aspire to is the best possible answers we can get to. So, you know, you if you want to know how many jobs it's going to create, you can work through, you know, so what's the nature of who's going to be doing what and what's it all add up to. Or if you want to know, you can sort of work through and develop estimates of what's your best guess of what sort of energy would cost if you don't have this, and then what's your best estimate of under alternative assumptions if you build this and sell it at a certain, you know, at the market rates or non-market rates, what, and, you know, the cost of the distribution facility. You can work back to a best estimate of how it might affect in-state costs. And my point is that we, as challenging and as sort of uncertain as those kind of estimates are, they are better off than winging it and say, oh, it's going to make gas cheaper. We have to, you have to go through the exercise and see, do you have any evidence to sustain what sort of what your instincts are, beliefs about what these benefits might be?
Okay, speaking of winging it, let's pretend you're candidates. You have to give a yes or no answer. You are not allowed to explain your answer or say maybe. Well, that's what they always ask candidates at forum, right? So, question is, in terms of making the final determination of what's in the best interest from this project, the state investment, best interest finding, if you will, at DNR, the legislature or a vote of the public, up or down on this decision? So, I guess legislature or
the legislature.
Vote. Marty?
The people.
And Gunnar? And don't say academia. It's not an allowable answer. Public or legislature?
You know, my instinct is on a complex topic like this.
The guy's running for office. We just don't know which one.
No, the legislature.
Okay, a couple more questions. Dermot, you talked about the history where power cost equalization for bush communities, funding for Susitna, Bradley Lake. As you look ahead to a gas line and the money the state would be putting into it, is it possible to come up with a geographic balance on the benefits? Certainly just by where the molecules are, they'll be weighted on the rail belt. Is it possible, desirable?
Yes, there will be a balance, but whether or not it appeals to everyone is the question. Is the balance determined by a legislative majority? Probably. Let me cycle back to one issue that I think it's a small one, but it puts this gas challenge into perspective a bit. Again, Alaska's largest refinery is shut down. One of the key reasons is the price of jet fuel at Anchorage International Airport, which is cheaper to import from overseas than to produce in Alaska, make a profit, and sell in Anchorage. So how do you balance that issue where you're losing a certain number of jobs, you're losing some state revenue, you're importing oil from overseas that's cheaper because refinery operations in Taiwan and Singapore are a great deal cheaper than they are in Alaska. That's a really difficult thing to figure out, especially because we don't know the books of Flint Hills, right? We don't know what they're doing exactly. So this is going to be a lot more difficult with the gas line. And we were unable to deal with Flint Hills, right? Or I guess maybe we dealt with it by not providing, you know, discounted oil. Yeah. So anyway, that was okay. A long answer, sorry.
Okay, last question, so after one, people certainly are free to stay around and hassle any of the panelists, Gunnar in particular. But Marty, this is, I think, best for you. What is the role of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission in oil and gas production decisions to satisfy that maximum benefit as you think about getting as much oil out of the ground when you start taking out gas too?
The AOGCC looks to the downhole. Their job is to conserve the resource in the field. It is not to look at what might be in Alaska's economic interests or not. For instance, I mean, one of the biggest issues that has yet to be determined has to do with Point Thompson. There are people who consider that to be an oil field, and there are people who consider that to be a gas field. So at the end of the day, that will be determined by AOGCC if all things remain equal, unless the legislature changes the rules on that. But that is not going to be determined by AOGCC dependent upon whether or not that gas is necessary for a gas pipeline. At this juncture, given this set of rules, they will determine that as to what they feel the best conservation of that field will be.
Thank you. With that, it's after one. Like I say, you're free to hang around and talk to panelists. I want to thank Marty Rutherford, Gunnar Knapp, Dermot Cole for participating, volunteering today. And thank you for coming.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans. This panel on Alaska's plans for a natural gas pipeline was hosted by Commonwealth North and was recorded May 28th at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center. The panelists you heard from were Marty Rutherford, Dermot Cole, and Gunnar Knapp. Larry Persley moderated the discussion. Thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Beatty Trantina. Thank you for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.